Welcome to Driven Minds. I'm Gigi, and this is a Type 7 podcast. Our guest today is Suki Waterhouse. Suki is an actress, singer-songwriter, and model who was first scouted when she was 16 and went on to model for the likes of Burberry and Balenciaga. As a musician, her single titled Good Looking was certified gold, and her debut album, I Can't Let Go, came out last year. So this episode was recorded before the 2023 SAG-AFTRA strike, so please note there is purposely no mention of her acting career. So here it is, my conversation with Suki Waterhouse. Can you introduce yourself? What do you want people to know about you?
What do I want people to know? My name's Suki Waterhouse. I am an incredibly messy human, which you might not be able to see behind me, but it's gotten so bad that I had a professional cleaner come in yesterday, like a professional organizer, like someone that's just like professionally out of their mind and comes over and just like labels, puts all of your jeans color coded and lines them up. And it's actually, I've been having such a crushing weight of anxiety because I've moved. I wasn't there for the move. So everything just got boxed up and sent. And I kind of am a little bit OCD about just like random things and where they are. Like it could just be like something really banal, but if I don't know where it is and it's not in my kind of like collection of mess, which I find quite a lot of safety and security in, then I just go nuts. So it's been like 6 months of not really unpacking, and I feel like I can't even like make more music or like another album until I have like some sort of like sense of like order going on.
That really affects me too, though. And I always underestimated it. I have actually OCD, like debilitating OCD, but it doesn't manifest with organization. It's like the one perk about the thing I don't have. Like I'm so clear-headed when my space is clear, yet it's like I always am like, I'll do it tomorrow. So as a result, I have like a table of just shit, like receipts, papers just like piling up that I'm like, I'll do it tomorrow. And then as I say, I'll do it tomorrow, the stack like slowly like climbs up to Narnia, and I'm just like,
yeah. We did yesterday, we had like a neutral box, a donate box, and you have to take out these things that you don't really want to put away and just put them on a table in a neutral space and really just stare at the object. It feels amazing. Donating just like six bags of things is wonderful.
You're also just petrified by how much you accumulate. Like whenever I do this, I'm just like, why am I keeping a shirt from sixth grade? You know?
It's absolutely like, disgusting. Like a belt with like an eagle on it. I'm like, I'm not this girl anymore. I'm not this girl anymore. Even just like saying goodbye to my, like some of the plants that I have, because I've like moved in with my boyfriend now, and I always used to live alone. I just went past my house last night, my old apartment, which I spent like 8 years in, and I suddenly was getting like the heartburn for that street, you know, and like, I was like, I can't believe I'm not there anymore. And now I have to like consider someone else.
It's a big move. I've never lived with someone. I've always been like way too scared to make that move because I feel like there is a part of me that is just so tethered to my autonomy. But then when I've actually lived with someone for like 2-3 weeks on like a vacation, I've actually loved it. But I've always been too scared to make the actual big move. So I applaud you. You are a bigger woman than I am.
It doesn't feel like that much of a crazy thing. And I'm very lucky because he is so accepting of the mess and the chaos. He never says anything about it. He kind of thinks it's like charming. So I'm very lucky for that.
So pre-organization, you grew up in West London. Your dad was a cosmetic surgeon. Your mom was a cancer care nurse?
Cancer nurse, yeah.
Cancer nurse.
They met with a patient. And my mom swears that this
patient... So romantic.
Kind of, well, wait, I think this is the spoiler, but my mom swears that the patient had a decaying buttock. And that is her narrative. And my father's is completely different. My dad's is that he was walking down the hallways. At the time, he had all these girlfriends who worked at the hospital. And then he stopped and saw my mom. And he stopped dating everyone else and just pursued my mom. That was how they met. And then my mom had four of us, me, my sister, and then they had twins, which was completely unexpected. And that kind of threw her out for a while. And then she went and trained as a child psychologist. And She's been doing that ever since. She works in schools for a great charity called Place to Be. She's amazing. She was always the person that all of my friends would come and speak to. And it's funny when your mum's sort of a psychologist, she's always speaking to everyone else and empathizing with everyone else. And we would always get jealous, being like, you're so empathetic with everyone else, but with your own kids, you're like, you're a bunch of brats. Like,
right, exactly.
You're the worst kids ever. And we'd be like,
but you're so nice to Molly.
Molly's actually the name of my best friend. Yeah. Funny, you got the name right.
I remember when my sister was born, she's 5 years younger than me, and I always wanted a sibling. And then my sister came, and I was like, you can't do anything with her. This doesn't look like Full House.
Right.
This disappointment. She's like a peanut. She doesn't do anything, you know?
Me and Imogen were very close and quite close in age. So there's sort of like that separation of the older two and then the younger two that we got to kind of run around with and be crazy with, and also really help raise, because it was a crazy place.
Yeah.
Our mum was just always like exhausted. And my mum always like talks about the madness crystallized and having twin kids running around, having them as babies. She's like, my craziest moment was agreeing that you guys could get a lizard.
We want the weirdest pets when we're little. I had a turtle and I bathed with my turtle. Do you know how dangerous that is?
She was,
you know,
you bathed with your turtle, like, what's going on?
I know.
We had a lizard, and like, my dad's, like you said, a surgeon. He's so OCD. The only things that we had in the living room were like Roman coins and then this giant picture of a brain and some skulls. Like, he's incredibly just literal, and the space needs to be perfect. And poor guy would come home, like, four kids and a lizard, hamsters, and then not only the lizard, but you have to buy the insects and feed them as well. So in the basement, there were all these like cockroaches running around everywhere. It was feral.
So you spent your childhood and teenage years in London.
Yeah.
And I read an interview actually where you recounted a time where you were bullied by girls at school, or you had some bad experience with a girl. I feel like that was like in part of my research.
Yeah. I did have a bad experience with a girl. I wouldn't say that I was like bullied. There was like an event that happened at school. I'd sort of like tried to befriend this girl, and then she sort of like took the boyfriend I have off me, and then everyone separated.
Oh, cardinal sin.
But it was like then the next few years, everyone's going out with all of their friends and everything. So I just spent the last like couple of years of school, I was just screwed at that point. I just spent a lot of time in the library,
same,
not going to lunch. I was annoyed about that, but I was also, it didn't ever quite click at school. And I think I wanted to be part of a friend group. And I did have friends at school, but I also kind of started having this feeling of like, quite early on, to be honest, of like, fuck this, I really want out. And I started finding friends and other things to do in London, and I started going out. It actually gave me, I think, a very pivotal feeling of like revenge in some way. And
I so get that.
And I think revenge is the most powerful thing. Like, you always have to have something to be in opposition to actually give you energy and fire.
100%.
If everything's too easy, then you don't have anything to go against. And I've always had, I think it's like maybe a Capricorn tendency as well. I've always been incredibly grateful for them because I will take it and be in a lot of pain, and then it will really like fuel me.
I so get that. And I had actually something so similar to me happen, but I was specifically completely tortured by this one girl. And I feel like whenever we think of the people who torture us too, or like girls that we don't like, or people in general, we always think like first and last name, right?
Oh yeah.
You know, like mine is like, it is so definitive.
We both had a W surname, so we were always sat next to each other. We always had to do like projects together.
So same with me and her, by the way. That's wild. Yeah.
So we would just like sit in silence, and we'd have to do some kind of project together. And I just would be like, no, I'm not gonna.
Yeah.
I think she was also probably like a little scared of me, because I was pretty icy. And I do sort of remember playing rounders, you know, that,
yeah,
and sort of like trying to aim the ball for her head. So I won't position myself as a complete victim.
Revenge kickball. I like it. And were you modeling during this time?
Yeah. So when I was at school, at secondary school, you have like these kind of scout mother agents. And I met a woman out in a Topshop or something like that. Mm-hmm. And what she did is take me to agencies. But there was kind of like an interim period where I think you had to get ready to go and be able to see the agencies, which basically meant like you need to just become half the size in my case.
I know Burberry was like your first big thing. Right. And was this around the time when you were in school?
No. So that, I think my first job before I got signed, I had a quite funny story. I went to a party and I met the owner of Chrome Hearts. I was really young, probably like 16 or 17. And I met the owner of Chrome Hearts and we got on really well. I still know her. Her name's Laurie Stark. And she said, well, I'd love to book you for this campaign in LA. And I remember it was the week of my GCSE. So it was kind of the week that everyone was studying for these quite pivotal exams. I had the plane ticket booked and my mum, my poor mum, just did not have any kind of idea what the hell was going on. And I went with this mother agent and I just got on the plane and I was obviously like so excited.
So Chrome Hearts was so cool.
It was so cool. And then I got to the shoot and it was me and Iggy Pop that did the shoot together.
Casual.
Crazy. I remember I stayed at the SLS and they sort of took me to the Chateau Marmont and I couldn't believe it. I was walking around Hollywood and it was all completely alien to me. But that was sort of like one of the first experiences. And then before I got Burberry, I went to a couple of different agencies.
Yeah.
I left one agency because they basically stopped paying me and just said everything's in cash. So I'd have to collect cash and then give it to them. And then they would just start saying, oh, it's all for expenses, basically.
Yeah,
all
that's of your horse poop.
Paychecks. But then you find out that they're, you know, that they're going down.
So your modeling career was on the up and up. And eventually when you were doing really well, you mentioned that you fell into some sort of depression, which sounds counterintuitive, but I actually also find when we're at the top is like when we all of a sudden hit a low. And I was curious what brought on the depression.
I think actually probably like the shock of suddenly being able to go online and read every single awful thing you've probably ever thought about yourself, just reflected back to you in such great magnitude. And that's just something that you learn to deal with. And compared to then, when you're already a young person who's trying to figure out how to have boundaries, and you're also really vulnerable. You're vulnerable to bad relationships and shit people. And that shock of kind of having not only myself criticized, but also everything in my personal life was just so out there. And it was, I felt like I wanted to retreat. And I think like a heavy dissociation happens because you learn how to compartmentalize working and just basically like switching off from your body quite a lot.
Mm.
You kind of have to almost like leave your brain when you're being stared at by 30 people on a job and they're kind of going like, your thighs are too big, like you should lose there.
Picking you apart.
Yeah, picking you apart. It's funny because I never really had a problem with, I didn't really ever dislike my body that much, but.
And you like learn to dislike it because of them.
Well, yeah, but when you're working within these kind of like set of rules, I've always been sort of like a normal sized thin person, but I'm not thin enough.
Right.
I still couldn't always get the pair of trousers on, and I, you know, I had a bit of a bigger butt, so you'd have to like kill yourself to be able to get to that point.
But how do you deal with the depression? Like, what would alleviate the pain at the time?
I think I first started going to therapy when I was about 18. She unfortunately passed away now, but I have a new therapist that's amazing. But she was brilliant and she was fairly unboundaried, but she was wonderful. And she used to smoke cigarettes in this little apartment in Notting Hill, and that was the first time that I sort of had gotten to speak to anyone and sort of unravel the chaos in my household and a lot of things that had happened growing up that made it a sort of safe and unsteady place. And we sort of unfurled that actually kind of, I'd already had some problems with binge eating and starving and all that kind of stuff.
Same.
Mm-hmm.
Binge eating was debilitating for me.
Yeah, binge eating was crazy. Yeah, I used to not eat all day at school and refuse to eat anything. And then I would go home and just take apart the family fridge. And actually my parents, even though they're doctors, they would just be like mad at me. And it would,
yeah.
And my dad, who's like the very OCD doctor who like needs everything to be clean. And he'd be like, what the, you know, like so upset about it and just yell at me.
Further shaming.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, I'm already ashamed that I just ate 5,000 calories in 10 minutes. Like, you don't need to pack it on.
Yeah. And then I would feel so unwell for like days and days and days. And then you try and counteract that with different things. And
restricting.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did.
Yeah.
I would like eat 10,000 calories literally in like 20 minutes. I'd like buy shit from the local bodega next to my house in Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
Would buy all this stuff, literally eat like any bad junk food that was deprived from me when I was a kid, I would buy, eat it all, and then not eat for like the entire next day and a half.
Yeah, and it only actually dysregulated me and made it harder to stay in shape. Now that that's completely just left me, it's so much easier to just stay the same. I used to really swing by about 10 pounds. Like I could go all over the place. That was quite difficult to sort of like manage. And the idea that you could eat, you know, three times a day or more or whatever, it didn't really like occur to me that that was the thing. And I think it was something to do with actually coming home is what would trigger it. Coming back into the house. And I notice that actually, I think that impulse is always there whenever I go to a hotel room, because I travel a lot and I walk into a hotel room.
Minibar.
The minibar. Yeah, there's something about the sort of anxiety about being in this new place. I think I've kind of broken my brain in some way with traveling, because I was thinking about what I really want in the next few years. And I was like, I'd like to stay home a little more, I think. I'd like to have longer stretches of time at home where you're not always thinking about moving and running around. Like, it's terrible in every single way. It's bad for everything.
You said you turned to music because you were drowning in your life. And I'm curious what was going on when you started writing songs.
I actually had always been making music all through modeling. And that was always my original plan. It was always what I thought I was going to do. It's amazing. Like, it took me, I think, 10 years of making music to finally get to a point where I felt like I had an album, but I would write music constantly. That was the best thing that I had, was to be able to get to develop it privately. And I never really kind of like spoke about it that much to friends. Like, they knew it was happening, but it's kind of, it just wasn't something in my life that had an industry around it or had anyone. Everything's very different now. It's like you're talking about album campaigns and what the next single is going to be, and there's 6 months until we have to put the album out, and you know, there's time crunches and everything like that. But I'm actually very glad that it didn't end up being the first thing that I did as a job, you know.
But in what way did it help you at a time when you were struggling?
When we have painful moments, I think when you're in them, there are times when you're just like, I don't know how I'm gonna ever get out of them. And everybody experiences just like horrible, massive amounts of pain. And I think you have to figure out a way to add oxygen to that feeling. It's about oxygenating it. So writing about what I was going through and taking, you know, the night I spent at a hotel, like just sobbing on the floor. Like, this is just one story, but like I go down to dinner and you know, the person that I'd just broken up with, this new girlfriend's there and like everything. And I go back up to my room and I run upstairs and I'm sobbing. Oh, and like, you know, God. Those kinds of nights or those periods. Because actually, like, that moment didn't really like last like a couple of months. It sort of like lasted a couple of years.
Which moment?
Just like big, colossal, young, heartbreak, public, everything. Yeah. It's just, I think there are like moments in your 20s that are like very defining.
Totally.
You also, as you get older, you start to look back and be like, oh, there were so many things that were very weird and wrong about that whole thing. But those are the things that you take and you go, how am I going to oxygenate this? And I had this dream to put out a record. And I always like have this saying, like, you should never laugh at people's dreams. But I kind of like had to really tell myself that myself, because I did laugh at that dream for a long time. And I started with just the first song I put out was called Brutally. And that was like the first song I'd made that I actually felt like truly proud of. And that was something I actually wanted to share. But it really was like drip, drip, dripping music until I felt like I have everything.
What was a struggle that you had to go through that ended up being a valuable experience?
I've been ghosted and broken up with after dating someone for a year. That was pretty bad. But it turned out to be brilliant because I took a bout of celibacy.
Ooh, for how long?
It was quite a long time. It was like, I think I set myself the exact thing, I think 6 months.
That's impressive.
Is it though? I think a lot of people, some people are like, I've done a year or whatever. But
also depends how you define celibacy.
No dates, no nothing.
That's impressive. No sex. I could do no sex for 6 months, but no dates, like no male attention.
You actually can hear yourself so much clearer. It's just something about taking away like the chaos of receiving attention and having to deal with it and texting people and getting kind of like those lurches of excitement. And that was like,
it's so all consuming.
Yeah, I think it was actually turned out to be great because I got very clear and I got very used to being like comfortable with myself. Then I ended up like meeting my boyfriend now. So it felt like kind of an extra special in a way. This is really ridiculous. Okay.
No, it's not ridiculous at all. I'm actually doing the exact thing that you're doing right now, except my bar is a lot lower than yours. I was like, I will do 30 days of no men, you know, no texting, no, like if a guy flirts with me at a bar, I turn him away and I have an inner calmness that I've never felt before.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, that I've always used like other people and like other relationships to like distract myself from myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. And you also suddenly have so much more time. It's like
completely.
A wonderful. It's not about like figuring out what you don't like. I mean, it is, but it's really about like discerning your tastes and what you do like, just not in terms of like men, but also just in terms of what you really like for your life, what your tastes are, what like turns on your senses. And when I put energy towards that, instead of like kind of all the things I don't have or the ways that I wish things were.
Like living in lack.
Yeah, living in lack and just, and actually really spending time figuring out what I like. It fills you up so much more.
Yeah.
It's a cool thing to try at some point. But I feel like people listening to this are probably like, whatever, that's not that long. Like I know so many of my friends are like, I'm on like a year and a half.
Well, I have friends that are like, I'm doing it, but not intentionally, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's a crazy place like dating out there at the moment. It's a random offshoot, but I was sat waiting for my friend at dinner last night. She was like 20 minutes late and I was at the bar and this man came over and he was like, can I sit down and talk to you while you wait for your friend? And I was like, okay, yeah, come and like sit down. And everyone was like watching this happen. I just felt quite awkward saying no, and it sat down. And the first thing that came out of this man's mouth was, I'm an arms dealer. I sell bombs and missiles and planes and I sell them to Ukraine. And he goes, I keep the world safe. And I was like, oh my goodness. He did not ask me one question for 20 minutes. And I just sat there in absolute awe. I was like, this is just brilliant. And then it was like, oh, he'd suddenly be like, I golf with Tom Brady. And I'm like, He's like, I'm at the same golf course as Tom Brady.
Oh my God, goodbye.
I was like, damn, it is rough out here for the ladies.
It is rough out here. The worst thing about dating, I think, and the biggest red flag for me, and I'm curious what yours are, mine is when I go out on a date and the guy does not ask one question about me.
Mm-hmm.
What are your red flags? Like hard nose.
There's been relationships where there have just been so many blinding red flags and I've just bowled them over and continued to
same.
Be in them.
Yeah. But do you think back on those times and you're like, what was I thinking? Like it was all written literally in front of me.
Yeah, sometimes. But I think if you really do encounter like a sociopath or a narcissist, I think that's like a whole different ballgame. I'm obsessed with Dr. Ramani at this point. Do you know Dr. Ramani?
No, tell me.
Your world's just been like completely flipped upside down. She's a doctor that specializes in narcissism.
Have you dated a narcissist?
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Oh my God, how was that?
You're kind of constantly in this fear state where little things that you do, anything can kind of set them off. So it changes your brain and you're sort of constantly in that state of anxiety and fear.
Mm.
And then you try and sort of like rectify that. It actually makes you like spill your guts more and like tell them everything. You know, then you bond and then they use that against you. It's a crazy cycle. But I think how I dealt with it was sort of just looking at like, it's a cycle of pain and trauma in that person's life as well. And all you can ever really wish for when you're done being like angry and going through every kind of feeling of injustice, I think you get to a place where you're just like, I just want that person to heal, or I hope that they do. Or you just have to understand that there are so many things in life that are just so opposing to yourself. And there are so many things that you just can't change. And you just have to grow a new life around the pain that you kind of encountered. But for me, the one thing that I like really cherish in relationships is when somebody's just like completely understanding of like, oh, you have to go and work, you have to go and tour, you have to go and when you're both comfortable in being able to leave. Because I always think like the home is the sanctuary and it's where you leave everything outside and you come and replenish. Like I imagine it's like you go and like have to like slay your dragons and go around the world and into the wild. And when that home center is secure, that's the most wonderful thing. And that's the most important thing to me.
My favorite relationship advice is marry someone it's easy with, which sounds so boring, but the older I get, the nicer it sounds.
Yeah, you know? I don't find it attractive anymore. Yeah. I don't believe it should be difficult.
Totally.
It's sexy to be with someone who's kind to you.
You've been open about toxic relationships. I'm just curious, like, what your personal most effective way when it comes to, you know, a breakup with a narcissist or whatnot, like, what do you find most effective in getting out of that space?
I mean, I think even trying to like find the word to describe it or something like that, like, takes a long time. I don't think you're in something and you go like, I'm in a relationship with a narcissist, because that's not how it works. You're kind of like brainwashed. You're sort of like in a behavior pattern, and then you're sort of like reacting to that. And
how was it toxic for you? Because sometimes it's hard to see the warning signs. And for anyone else who's going through a toxic relationship, maybe your experience could help them.
I think what's toxic is like being put down, being deceived, being betrayed. I think a lot of the time, like, narcissists will really, really want to convince you that what they say is true and that they're like so morally upright. It can even be something like, you can get home from a night out and it's like, I can't believe that you ate that dessert when we were all sharing it. I can't believe you like put your spoon in it first. And like, you know what I mean? Like something.
Oh my God. That has literally happened to me. Literally.
Yeah. I think a lot of the times in toxic relationships, it can be like, even the second you get in the car, it's like, I can't believe that you were looking at that person like that. You were flirting with that waiter, or you were doing something like, you wanted that. And you're just like, what on earth is going on? Like, I feel crazy right now. So I think a lot of the times it's where you feel like your reality is just constantly being questioned. And I've been out with people that have said things like, you know, isn't it great that I don't drink or take drugs, or, you know, that I'm sober, because, you know, I would never betray you. I could never cheat on you because I'm sober all the time. And I'm like, you know, like this. And then actually they're just cheating on you all the time. It's really fucked up. And like, after a while and like years go by and you start talking to people that have also dated them. Yeah. Yeah. And then, and then you reveal so many similarities, and that's like a big moment that really changes your whole perspective, because there's nothing more kind of like shocking and also just like healing is when other women you can all get together. And it's not about, I'm going to do something about this. It's just actually a way to understand your own experiences better than you ever would have been able to by yourself, because you can look at another woman and be like, this is wrong. And then you go, oh, this is exactly the same thing that happened to me. So your empathy grows for yourself, your understanding, you start researching. That's like an extreme situation. Like, I've also gone out with a lot of really nice people and have, you know, and have kept staying friends. And again, I would never change anything to have been different.
You learn so much.
Yeah. There's always so many things that you gain from every shit thing that ever happens to you.
100%. And I think like the biggest thing, this is like quintessential through all toxic relationships, is like why you stay. Mm-hmm. I keep a journal and I wrote like, I am completely obsessed with my harasser. Mm-hmm. I'm in so much pain, but like, I can't not text him back. Mm-hmm. It also shows you your self-work that you have to do on your own.
That's a massive thing about it, because you can't really do anything about the other person. You get so crazy about trying to make somebody see what they're like and, you know, exactly, all that kind of thing. And you're like, why aren't you changing? And actually it's completely,
you feel crazy,
redundant. Yeah, you feel completely crazy. So you get hooked on that. The intimacy and the bond becomes, even if it's a, when it's like toxic, like we're saying, it's an incredibly strong bond. It's like weaning yourself off of heroin, basically.
Literally feels that. Like, I know what addicts feel like because I like am so obsessed with this person. Mm-hmm.
You change your mind constantly. You've made up your mind and then something happens. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, they also know how to play on your emotions and pull you in different directions, and everything can be so subtle, and suddenly you can wake up and completely change your mind and think, well, yeah, you know, I have loads of issues too. Like, I think I'm crazy, or
it's not that bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad. Yeah. You need a lot of time.
And also like the reconciliation high, the moment where like you work out the fight and you're like, oh, okay, things are back to normal. Like, we're at a baseline again.
It's the relief. You've come off being on fight or flight and you're back to feeling normal again. And the moments where you feel normal and not insane become like little highs themselves that you just feel so grateful to be back in the good books or feel. Yeah, it's basically like doing skydives all the time. Like you become like an adrenaline junkie, and the bonds that you make with somebody are so kind of permanent, which is why I think the beginning of a relationship is so important. Kind of like the rules that you set at the beginning. Not that it even have to be spoken, but like the way that you treat each other at the beginning. And
the boundaries you put up, like, hey, let's not do that again. That kind of comment's not acceptable.
Yeah. You kind of learn so much at the beginning. It's like, oh, you're cool if I have to work late tonight, and if I have to come home late, or if you have to come home late, you know, I'm not going to chastise you for that or anything like that.
Or question where you were.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, you have to go off and do this. I'm not going to make you feel guilty for leaving me. You just having that security and trust at the beginning of something. I always think it's quite telling and showing. And also I really believe that like, you should really just be like having like a laugh. Like
a ball.
Yeah, a ball. Yeah.
You know?
I don't think it should be that stressful. Obviously, you go through like difficult things, but you can go through difficult things and still kind of be having a ball, to be honest.
I know you're in a really happy relationship now. Did you set any of these kinds of boundaries before going into this one? Like, was there something about this one that like made it more successful?
I don't know. Maybe for me, it was about actually feeling ready in a way that I haven't before, that I actually had something to give.
Yeah.
I've sat with myself. I've been in a couple of different kinds of relationships. I know what I would quite like, and I would really like a peaceful, fun scenario, but not just like what I'm trying to will in, but it's like, oh no, I actually have something to share now. I have like a life that I'm proud of, that I want to share with someone, and I'm stable, and I have my shit together, kind of.
Enough.
Yeah. I think that was probably like how I felt coming into it. You can't really quite plan for it, but I think I've said in an interview before, I'm like, oh, I'm really surprised that I'm still really happy and that's happened. It's like, I get shy.
I hear you. Of course, there's like no pressure to say anything. It's just always so interesting to me why some relationships work and why some don't, no matter how much work you put into this, you know?
Yeah.
Like this piece of poop that I'm in is the relationship I've worked the hardest on.
Yeah.
And it's always just wild timing and how when I am ready for the first time, after like 4 years of like insane therapy, both psychedelic and normal, I've like gone to a psychiatric hospital for my OCD. I've done like a million of these programs in LA, like the Hoffman process. I don't know if you've
heard of this. Yeah, I've got some friends that have just done that.
It's amazing.
They all come back from the Hoffman process like
glowing
and everything. I know. And I was just at a dinner the other day, and there was like a gaggle of girls I was talking to, and everyone's just like, oh, you've done it. And it's kind of like, you kind of feel like quite othered when you haven't done it, because everyone's just like on this complete high. And do you keep up with the work as well?
Yeah, you do keep up with the work. I've basically just been doing so many programs like this. You know, I also realized like I cannot be in a relationship until I'm at a place with myself that I just feel so calm and comfortable, and like I face the void, right? Like when I wake up with no texts on my phone, like that's usually when I panic. And I'm like, I want to be able to do that and just have such a calm and solid sense of self where it's like I don't need any external affirmation or validation besides what comes from myself. And that was really like the place where I got to. And then to have a relationship not work out when like you're in this space, like there's like a sense of power of like knowing that you'll be okay, but it's also like I'm ready, I put everything into this, I was my best self. And then when it doesn't work out, when you're like your best self in it, you're just like, oh.
And you just never know. Even looking at my parents' relationship, there were like loads of rocky years. It was always like gonna get divorced, like fighting. And actually I think it's like very stressful having kids and like raising kids and having jobs.
Oh my God.
I like can't even imagine how stressful it is.
Does it make you want them, or are you kind of just like, yeah?
I don't think I would have four.
that's like a mother load.
But they're still together. They weathered a lot of discomfort together, a lot of, even when it was bad, they really did love each other and they stuck in there. You can see that like both of them are like crazy and very opposite and different in their own ways, and it complements each other. Like you don't have to be completely similar to have something work. I think you can be quite different. I read this book recently, The Four Noble Truths of Love. Have you read that book?
No, tell me everything.
It's Susan Peaver. I was watching an interview with her the other day, and she was saying how, like, she's like, I have nothing in common with my husband, and we've been together for years. She's like, he loves, like, being super social and wants to go out, and she's a Buddhist, and she loves being alone and introspective, and she talks about how different you could be.
So interesting.
Yeah. One of the noble truths, I think, was good manners, which is always having good manners in everything. Like, in conflict, you have to have good manners. Like, you have to, like, bring yourself to the table, express what you feel without attacking the other person, stand next to them when there's, like, a huge mountain that you feel like you guys are jumping off, when there's an issue in front of you. Like, you have to be well-mannered even in those times that are difficult. And I loved that noble truth. I thought that was so important, because that's really difficult.
Just to dovetail on what you said about, like, this woman whose partner she has nothing in common with. There was, like, some therapist on Instagram who posted this reel of saying, like, something calmer can exist. Someone who you could sit across from a dinner table with and actually have nothing in common with could, like, actually be your best match.
I think sometimes you need, like, commonality on certain things. Like, I guess your morality compass and what's important to you, but you don't both have to like being in the outdoors.
Or yeah, exactly.
They can be very opposite things. And I think that that can be a really beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. The things that you really lack and do not have, you can turn to your partner for insight and have the perspective of someone that's not completely similar to you.
Is there a quality that like you lack that you always tend to look for in someone else?
I think like a kind of sense of consistency, a consistency in what they feel about things, like kind of like how they feel about the world. Because I think I can like constantly have my mind changed and like I'm quite curious, and I could get like sucked in and come out with a completely different opinion through like empathizing with someone deeply. And I quite admire when somebody's just kind of like, you know, like, oh, I've got the same kind of like thoughts about everything, and it doesn't waver that much, because I think I can be like pulled emotionally into quite different directions.
Consistency is a huge one for me. And this is what I'm dealing with right now too, is like knowing that your partner will show up in the same reliable way every day. Mm-hmm. You don't feel you have to walk on eggshells.
That's a huge one. That's completely changed my life.
In what way?
Well, like the difference of having someone that's like not like that. Like I've had boyfriends that won't really text or call for like a week sometimes.
Also, and then they put you in the position of being like needy and desperate, but you're asking for like basic needs to be fulfilled.
I just won't even ask because I'm like defiant like that. And then you're just like, wait a second, I'm meant to be with this person and I literally haven't spoken to them for 2 weeks. So that's...
Oh my God, I couldn't.
That's not gonna... that's just basically, you're just making it up. You're not actually in a relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that those kinds of consistent things, when you don't like have to ask for them, but they're just there because that's what's just built into the other person, that's a really nice thing. Or I like it if like I get like a little bit shifty, or like I like it if it's just instantly met with like humor.
Yes,
just
yes,
shut it down and say something funny, and you kind of feel that irateness to suddenly go like, oh, okay, all right, I'm back to laughing. Like when someone can kind of like pop a balloon in that sort of like anxious state, there's so much like humor to just being a human and existing. And I like it when someone can find the funny and the lopsidedness about just like the ridiculousness of being on this planet and trying to figure out what we're doing here.
When was the first time you felt anxiety?
The first time I felt anxiety, I think it was definitely in my home. My brother had learning difficulties when he was growing up, and he got sent away and had to leave the home. And I think that was like a huge source of conflict between my parents. Like my mum didn't want him to go and my father did. And it sort of upset the dynamic so much that I think that strain, seeing that in our whole household, that made me feel incredibly anxious.
Is anxiety something you still struggle with now?
Oh yeah, for sure. I try and think of it as just being such a normal thing. Like if we don't have some kind of fear in our lives, then I'm pretty sure that we try and create it anyway. So I think it might just be like a natural thing in life. Like the anxiety about like making one big step in your life, like even going to a job opportunity or going for a meeting, it's like you're making a huge leap, like you're jumping across. So of course there's going to be this like chasm of anxiety in the middle of it. So Yeah, I do. And I think I still struggle with it a lot of the times where if it becomes too much, I think something will switch off in my brain and things will happen. Like I'll run a bath and I'll overflow the bath because I've forgotten about the bath. So many things will be going on in my brain. And that's usually when I know that it's gone a little bit too far. But it kind of goes back to like the messiness and the chaos and not being able to like concentrate on something. That's like always the battle that I'm having with myself, is just to be able to sit and be still and focus on something for long periods of time, because there's always a lot of anxiety. But I think without that, I wouldn't be able to do anything that I do.
And how do you move through that?
I think a big cry, I guess. A lot of the times, like a big cry. I mean, I'll have, I don't cry that much, but then sometimes I've had like long periods where I'll just cry constantly for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I think with me, it seems it bottles up and then it will just, there'll be an overwhelming kind of anxious just state where I'll just feel so much kind of like grief. And actually sometimes I don't even, I remember it happened to me about a year or two ago, and I couldn't really say what it was really about, but I think it was sort of everything. The thing I want to get into this year is cold plunging. My friend was just telling me about
it. It's everything.
Do you do it?
I do it. I do it though only with a sauna. So like I'll go in the sauna and then directly in the cold plunge. First off, you feel like the most powerful person in the world, like getting into that cold water. Yeah. You feel so empowered sitting in something or doing something that is uncomfortable.
My friend was telling me about it last night and she's up to 7 minutes and she's like, everything about it, it's just like you have to overcome yourself. And she said you go in with the whole weight of the world, everything, you're anxious and nervous and all the thoughts, and she said you come out and you're just like, hey, I'm just like a happy camper.
Yeah.
I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And like, who gives a fuck what happens? It just erases everything because you've gone through something so intense. So I hate the cold.
By the way, I do too.
I don't even like putting my toe in a cold pool. So I'm saying it right now on Driven Minds podcast because I will listen back to this and it will...
Hold yourself accountable.
Hold myself accountable.
I'll follow up. How's that cold plunge going? But it's so interesting what you said about the cry, because I'm reading this book about cortisol, and when we cry, we actually cry cortisol.
Oh, wow.
We feel better because we actually cry stress hormones.
I didn't know that.
Because I always feel so relieved after crying. Like I could be going through the most devastating, as I am going through right now, 3-month breakup. And the moment I cry, I'm like, okay, I feel at peace now. You know?
It's so energizing. Going through a breakup is so energizing. I think it's the most amazing thing. You just re-energize in a completely different way, and all these amazing things come into your life, I think, after you get out of something that's not right for you anymore. I just think so many wonderful things are coming away. I really do think that there's just like a complete fire that comes into it. It's survival. You're losing like this idea of what you thought the future was going to look like what your present and what your past, and with that person, the story that you've created, and you just like get to rip down the whole story and start a new one. I mean, how great is that?
Well, you know, what's funny is like, that's always how I feel. And reflecting on my past relationships and the times that I've actually grown the most have always been breakups. But going through it, you're kind of like, no, please not now. And you're so afraid to feel the pain. But when you look back on it, you're like, those are the periods in which I grew the most.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know?
Like those places of discomfort. It's just like such a breeding ground.
Completely.
I'm so excited for you.
Well, any tips you have? I just got to like sharpen the scissors and like cut the cord.
If you have like any really traumatizing experiences, I think doing like CBT and hypnosis can help. If I've had like one event that's just kept replaying in my mind and kept making me feel so angry at somebody, then I've done some hypnosis to take that moment and just lessen it. And sometimes it can be great. I've got a friend who's just gone through a breakup, and she's an actress, and when she was breaking up, she did a movie and she was like, I just delivered the most brilliant performance, tears running down my face. Like, I'm just like this open, vulnerable person. And then she's gone back and done reshoots and she's like, the tears didn't come as easy. Like, you know, 6 months later, she's like, God damn it. And actually, I have that too. Now I'm making a second album. It's like everything I wrote was quite a long time ago from that record. And then you put it out and you tour it, and a lot of time passes by. And now writing the second one, I'm kind of in such a completely different state. I've really like healed from that, and I don't feel, it just doesn't trigger me in the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, you still write about your past, but you're not in the same
emotional space.
Yeah, it's interesting writing from like a more secure time in my life where I feel a lot more settled in myself and boundaried in myself, and I feel so much more kind of grown up. I have to keep touching wood. I'm like, don't will disaster into your life like, for songwriting. It's not good.
Last question. What drives you?
What drives me? I think trying to just discover and search for why we're all here. Whenever I think of myself in the world, I'm like, everybody like here before me, and like there's been thousands of years of all of us just like trying to figure out why things are so painful and difficult, and also just like why we choose to go on. And I'm driven by my ambition to go out and seek a world of things that I enjoy and people that I want to collaborate with and meet and speak, and people's stories. Like I'm just like amazed by every single human story. It's just like completely amazing of how we got to where we are, everyone. So I'm driven by telling those stories and telling my story, and I'm driven by the people that I love and figuring out how to love them good and care for them. And I think the core of it is the people that I love and how those relationships are.
That, my friends, was Suki Waterhouse. You can follow Suki on Instagram at Suki Waterhouse and me at Gillian Sagansky. As always, I want to hear what you think of this episode, an episode that you particularly love, that you want more of, who you want to hear from next. So shoot me a DM. Also, if you can rate the show and subscribe to it, I will be eternally grateful. It helps us all out because it takes a village to make a podcast. Until next time.